In the late 1940s, culture echoed reality in how seldom film dramas had a happy ending. Fiction, like fact, can't always contrive to have a perfect resolution. That was as true before the war as after. But the cinema of the 30s was nakedly and unashamedly escapist, in a way that the cinema of the late 40s and early 50s, in an age of profoundly lost innocence and social upheaval, couldn't be. When the director Anthony Asquith saw Terence Rattigan's play The Browning Version in 1948, he knew he wanted to film it. But the age's thirst for realism didn't extend quite that far, and it took 3 years before he could raise the money. Potential backers told him it was too downbeat. In many senses, they were right. The script drips with defeat, betrayal, demoralisation, injustice, pretense, hypocrisy, and failure. In the exclusive world of the West End Theatre, one could get away with such things. To put them before a mass cinema audience in the era of austerity and rationing was an enormous gamble. Rattigan was the preeminent playwright of that era, and with good reason. But his reputation, according not least to himself, nosedived from the moment Look Back in Anger was unleashed in 1956. It was as if John Osborne and his audience had decided Rattigan had never inhabited a real world, and his polite, ultra-middle-class drawing-room dramas were now, after this tsunami of realism, pointless. Those who thought such things had either never seen or had forgotten The Browning Version. A play and then a film of truly depressing realism that outlines personal, marital, and institutional failure with a clarity and honesty unusual for the time, if not unprecedented. The film is about mutually assured destruction within a marriage, about two people so unsuited it's astonishing they married in the first place. Michael Redgrave plays the desiccated classics master Andrew Crocker Harris, about to leave his post after 18 years because of ill health, to take a less demanding job at a less demanding school. His health appears to be failing. He can't be more than 50, though his hair is streaked with grey and he has the manner of the elderly. This, we deduce, is not least because of his termagant of a wife, Millie. She thought, as she says, she was marrying a man who'd end up headmaster of Eton and with a knighthood. Crocker Harris, who won a hatful of classical prizes and the Newdigate Poetry Prize at Oxford, is, as his repulsively smarmy headmaster tells him, perhaps the finest scholar ever to teach at the school. Yet he's a useless teacher, as he himself says in a speech of almost harrowing honesty at the climax of the film. He sees the Agamemnon not as a drama, but as a succession of lines to be construed. It wasn't always thus. He'd started, when younger, to make his own translation of it. But then, we intuit, the stuffing was knocked out of him by a combination of his own limitations and his demanding wife. So he never became headmaster of Eton or got his knighthood. He never progressed beyond the lower fifth. And, even if he'd been able to engage with his pupils, his ultra-logical and correct mind denied him the skill of hypocrisy, the capacity for dissimulation, and the downright dishonesty that Rattigan suggests are needed by those who get to the top in the teaching profession. The Agamemnon is well chosen as the text Crocker Harris tries to teach the lower fifth. It's a play about a woman who conspires with her lover to murder her husband. In her disappointment, Millie Crocker Harris has started to seek consolation elsewhere, most recently with Hunter, a science master, played with customary dash and with exceptional intelligence by Nigel Patrick, the ultimate 1950s screen smoothie. Hunter is everything Crocker Harris isn't. Popular with the boys, appealing to the ladies, flexible, humorous, immoral. But he's not amoral, as he shows in the film's key scene and afterwards. Crocker Harris is giving extra lessons to Taplow, a boy working hard to win promotion to another form. At their penultimate meeting before Crocker Harris leaves, Taplow presents him with a copy of Robert Browning's translation of the Agamemnon. It's plainly been some years since anyone showed Crocker Harris any kindness, and he's overcome with emotion. His wife, embittered not just by his failure, but by his reluctance to stand up to the headmaster and demand the school pay him a pension after such long service, is determined he should extract no pleasure from the gesture. She tells him Taplow had given him the book to get his promotion, not out of genuine affection. Hunter, who witnesses this sickening exchange, dumps her on the spot. Her time was up anyway, as he later admits to her, no doubt because of the unattractive and unappealing self-obsession and self-pity in which she wallows. Millie Crocker Harris seems to have been at the front of the queue when almost every moral handicap was handed out. As well as being financially rapacious and having a streak of sadism, she's also a snob, mentioning whenever possible that she has an uncle who is a knight, and less keen for it to be noted, as her husband, with his utter lack of snobbery, does, that her father owns a shop in Bradford. Millie has ironed out her West Riding accent, if she ever allowed herself to have one. Like all the self-obsessed, she's oblivious to how others note her faults. She doesn't notice how the other masters and masters' wives register an utter lack of interest in her knighted uncle, or how the older women, who've seen it all before, regard her as absolutely ghastly. Once one has detected her snobbery and understood her background in what the Victorians called trade, one understands what a catch the scholar and gentleman Crocker Harris was. She's a prime example of the rapid social mobility possible in the 20th century, and the shattering of traditional concepts of class caused by two world wars. In the Agamemnon, Clytemnestra's lover plots with her to kill her husband. Such a thing won't happen in this version. Hunter is at heart decent, one of nature's Edwardians, happy to console a woman in distress, but on a recreational and not a permanent basis. Millie can't believe it when he dismisses her from his life, so used is she to getting her own way. An air of desperation starts to surround her. If she loses Hunter, she may not have another chance. But Hunter tries unsuccessfully to console Crocker Harris by insisting Taplow meant a sincere gesture of regard by giving him the book. So defeated is Crocker Harris that he can't believe it. But his and Hunter's understanding of each other is about to become radically deeper, creating, ironically, a degree of trust that will allow Crocker Harris to recognise Taplow's sincerity after all. Without anger or malice, Crocker Harris tells Hunter that he's well aware he's been cuckolded by him. Hunter is driven to a moment of moral recognition of the sort Crocker Harris experiences permanently and instinctively. He speaks of his shame, and not only says the affair is over, but that he wishes to befriend Crocker Harris and visit him at his new school the following September, before Millie goes there. One senses this is the first time Crocker Harris has had such comradeship. The news that Hunter will be visiting him, rather than spending time with Millie as they'd planned, is the next twist of the knife into her, and a proper repayment for her vindictive cruelty. There's one character more repellent than Millie, a remarkable achievement, and that's the headmaster, played to perfection by Wilfred Hyde White. Rattigan seems to have anticipated by several decades the development of the late 20th century public school head, whose relationship with pedagogy is minimal, but whose command of the arsenal of the public relations man and politician is vast. There's silkiness, menace, cowardice, and vacuity in every line the headmaster speaks, his permanent air of false bonhomie surrounding him like a wave of nausea. He's an accomplished hypocrite. He fawns on the chairman of the governors, to whom he owes his position, and who is a general and a peer of the realm. He fawns on the parents of his charges, even though he struggles to remember their names. He even fawns on one of his junior masters, partly because that man is highly popular with the boys and is about to play cricket for England against Australia. Indeed, to accommodate his need to get to the test match on time, the final assembly of term is being held early in the morning. At this event, the departing masters address the school in ascending order of seniority. But because, as the headmaster tells Crocker Harris, the cricketer is so popular, he hopes Crocker Harris will waive his right and speak first, so that the cricketer can provide a suitable climax to the occasion. Thoroughly beaten by now, Crocker Harris agrees. The sophisticated classes are shown, in this film, to have lives every bit as scandalous as some among the lower orders, if not more so. The notion of their setting an example has been well and truly exploded. But two signs of grace come before the end. The first is Hunter's recognition that taking the easy option, and Millie's favours were, we sense, obtained with anything but difficulty, is not always commendable. We see his introduction to the concepts of shame and remorse, and his determination to make amends for the hurt he has helped cause, and it is a genuinely uplifting moment. But the climax of the film is Crocker Harris's speech to the school, which, despite the headmaster's wishes, he gives last, after the cricketer. Hunter has taught him to stand up for himself and assert his rights, and he does. And in his speech he issues such a categoric apology for his failures, both as a teacher and as a man, that the school, whether out of embarrassment or out of recognition of his moral example, gives him an unprecedented ovation. He may be reduced and demoted, but he goes off with his head held high. He shows, in his final farewell to Taplow, that he has learned both flexibility and humour. The film has no happy ending. Crocker Harris has still failed. But it's a failure that contains the seeds of a recovered self-respect and, as we sense Crocker Harris has discerned, hope for the future. That hope relies upon his asserting himself over his wife, possibly to the point of divorce, a course urged on him by none other than Hunter, who has cuckolded him. In 1944, 12,000 divorces were granted. By 1947, it was 60,000, a level not seen again until the 1970s. Divorce had been introduced only in 1858, and until the war was generally a matter of social disgrace. In the immediate post-war period, it assumed epidemic proportions. This is, because of its allusions to divorce and for other reasons, a subversive film, but subversive only in how it represents the realities of life and does not politely sweep them under the carpet. It shows not just a new acceptability of divorce, but also a new ease of adultery. It puts a torpedo through the public school system. It shows the claustrophobic and limiting quality of an institution that's supposed to be the gateway to success. It says something sharp about the ossified nature of the British establishment before the dawn of meritocracy. For that reason, it's amazing to read later criticisms of Rattigan that suggest an effeteness and undue delicacy. All Rattigan did was to attack society with as much underlying viciousness as John Osborne and his friends, but with more style, wit, and subtlety. His film won awards, deservedly, for Redgrave's acting and his script. What no one quite grasped at the time, though, was that the Browning version was revolutionary and broke the mould in ways we're still only beginning to understand.